Welcome to STEM Spots, a weekly science review produced in cooperation with the Missouri State University Department of Physics, Astronomy, and Materials Science.
Hi, this is Dave Cornelison, and you're listening to the webcast version of STEM Spots. And with me in the studio is David Claiborne, who's the interim director of the Master's in Public Health program for the College of Health and Human Services at Missouri State University. Thanks again for stopping by, David.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So, David, in your past life, so to speak, you were with the Navy for a number of years. Talk a little bit about your work on the epidemiology of vector-borne diseases.
A lot of what we did in the Navy was to try to keep the Marines from getting vector-borne diseases or insect-borne diseases wherever they deployed. And sometimes they go into some unique places. For instance, I deployed with the 1st Marine Expeditionary Force during Desert Shield and Desert Storm and spent about 7 months working with a variety of different diseases in Saudi Arabia. Also worked in Japan, in Korea, and in those places I worked on diseases ranging from leishmaniasis and Japanese encephalitis to malaria. And so the focus in that one was very applied disease prevention. But in order to know how to do that, basically you have to understand the epidemiology or how the disease is transmitted.
Right. And so let's talk more about that. There's vectors for these diseases, as you've already mentioned. There's hosts, and then there's vectors for the transmission and a reservoir of the material. And so the vectors most of the time that you're concerned with are what? Mosquitoes and what else?
Well, the mosquitoes are by far the most important. And secondary to them are the ticks, which are going to spread things like Lyme disease and Crimean Congo hemorrhagic fever. But there are other insects that are important as well. Sand flies are these very tiny little flies, about half the size of a mosquito, and they transmit a disease called sand fly fever, but they also transmit leishmaniasis, which is kind of a nasty disease. We also have fleas. We have certain mites that transmit various diseases, and there are other insects that transmit diseases from very tiny ones to quite large.
So let's talk about the effort that you're undergoing right now to look at mosquitoes in Missouri. So talk more about the population of mosquitoes in Missouri and how you hope to try to figure out what mosquitoes there are here and which mosquitoes in particular you are looking for.
Okay. There are several different mosquitoes in Missouri that may have the ability to transmit diseases. One thing that a lot of people don't understand is malaria used to be a very big disease here in Missouri. And we eliminated the disease, but the insect that the mosquito that transmits it is still here. And so there are lots and lots of mosquitoes like that that are capable of transmitting diseases that are still here in Missouri. The biggest ones right now, the ones that we worry about the most, are probably the ones that transmit West Nile virus, and there are several that have the ability to do that. However, there is also the yellow fever mosquito, which historically has occurred here, and it has the ability to transmit a variety of diseases from yellow fever to Zika. Fortunately, neither of those viruses occur here in Missouri. There are secondary vectors as well, however, that may have the ability to pick up these diseases even if the yellow fever mosquito is not here. To date, we've been running this survey for about 5 weeks now, and I have not found one yellow fever mosquito.
So how do you go about that? Tell me how you go about. You go out in the field, and what do you have to get to start trying to do this?
Okay, there are two life stages at which we try to find mosquitoes. One is the adult, the ones that fly around and bite you, and the other is as the immature larvae or pupae, which occur in water. And the water can range anywhere from very clean pond water to really nasty artificial containers. And so what we do is we put out a certain type of trap that's baited with carbon dioxide in the form of dry ice, and we catch the adults. We take them in, freeze them, and look under the scope and identify them according to the anatomy of the mosquito. The other thing we do is we sample water sources and bring the larvae in from those water sources. And currently our focus is on artificial containers. So at present, one of the best places to do this is auto salvage yards. And so we go in, we find the bed of a wrecked truck out back. the tires, various different containers all over that wrecking yard. So my students currently who are doing this are basically getting a tour of the auto salvage yards of Missouri, which should be an interesting way to see the state.
And so they get the larva, they bring them back, and then do you wait until they mature? Is that what has to happen?
Right. We bring them back into the lab, and we put them into what we call emergence cages, feed them a little bit of fish food, observe them while they mature, and then as they emerge, we're able to capture them, usually freeze them, and identify them.
So let's talk a little bit about what happens to these mosquitoes in the long run when they start to do what it is we don't want them to do. So let's presume for a moment that these two types of mosquitoes, one of which definitely exists here, could carry something that might be like Zika. Zika is something that's been in the news a lot lately. We know there's a variety of new information coming out about this all the time. So what does the mosquito need in order, it can't just live here, what else has to be present in order for a mosquito population to transmit a virus? Talk about temperature constraints, talk about environmental constraints, population issues, and things like that.
Okay. Well, as we know, mosquitoes are going to be cold-blooded animals. In other words, their body is regulated by the environment, not internally regulated. And so they need a warm environment, not only in which to grow, but also in order to provide the environment in which the virus will grow internally inside the body of the mosquito. Essentially, in order for them to transmit this virus, the virus has to replicate within the body of the mosquito, infect the salivary glands of the mosquito, and then inject it into a subsequent vulnerable host. So what they need is water of some sort, ranging from nasty water to pretty clean water. They need a warm environment because the growth of the virus and of the mosquito is dependent on temperature. And essentially they need a host from which to take a blood meal. The blood meal is not used for nutrition, it's used to make eggs, yolk for the eggs. So, but they still need it in order for the population to grow.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about what you said earlier, which was that Missouri at one time had a malaria problem. And yet you said that the vector for that, the particular mosquito that transmitted that, is still around. So talk about how malaria was eradicated from Missouri if at one time it was here. So what had to happen in that case?
There's a lot of things that contributed to the elimination of malaria, but the primary thing was basically an increase in the standard of living. Basically, people had better nutrition, they had better houses. A very, really important aspect was the fact that people started putting screens on their windows and getting doors on the front of their houses. The result of that was it kept the mosquitoes out at night and cut down on the chances that the malaria would be transmitted. Of course, after World War II, there was the development of what Winston Churchill called the magic white powder, which of course was DDT. And that was a very important thing to use to eliminate malaria from much of the world, including most of Europe, Japan, and the United States. In addition to that, there were many types of artificial quinines that were developed that were used to essentially eliminate the agent, the parasite, from the blood of the people living here. So all of these things combined basically served to eliminate the malaria from North America and other parts of the non-tropical world.
So in other words, even though the DDT would kill the mosquito population has obviously come back post use of DDT, but at the time, the intersection of all these various treatment methods, whether it's treating the disease in the person or getting better hygiene or screens, forced essentially an eradication of the virus. And so now, are we saying that the virus no longer exists essentially in Missouri, or that it just is never, or it's just at such a low incidence that there's no transmission of it?
You're talking about malaria?
Yeah, malaria.
Yeah, the parasite does not exist here in Missouri unless it is imported.
So let's talk about a related thing. So when the Panama Canal was being built, there was a huge influx of, what was it, yellow fever at the time or something like that? And malaria. And in that particular case, what was the attack method? Wasn't it, let's totally eradicate the mosquitoes? Was that the tack that they took? Because there was a great effort underway to try to make it safe down there.
That's a really good question, because there were a lot of things that they tried. And one of the things they did was they basically built these wagons that would drip oil out the back, and they would drive around and they would just oil all the standing water. But they also did everything else, from rebuilding houses so that water wouldn't collect in the eaves and various other places. And they even took out a bounty on mosquitoes. So I don't know what the bounty was, but for every 10 mosquitoes, you'd get a penny. And so there were young boys and men who actually made a living basically going around collecting mosquitoes and picking up the bounty on them.
The oil in the water, what does that disrupt the larval state of the mosquito?
Yeah, basically the larvae breathe through kind of a snorkel. And if you cover the top of the water with some type of an oil, it fouls up that snorkel and prevents them from breathing.
So let's talk about, in the context of public policy that might result from some of the stuff that's going on. We'll talk more about it in a minute. But there has been talk that one of the ways we could approach this is to eradicate the mosquitoes. First of all, that sounds difficult, being as how there's more than one species, and unless you know what you're doing, you can't type these mosquitoes anyway. So what is that a response that's rooted in anything realistic, or would you say that that's kind of an unrealistic thing to think about?
Not only is it unrealistic, it would be ecologically a disaster. There are lots of fish, birds, bats that depend on, not so much birds, but certainly bats, that depend on mosquitoes as a food source. And so elimination of mosquitoes would have some pretty dire effects on the fauna of the state. There are a lot of other things, however, that can be done that basically cut down on the contact between humans and mosquitoes that are probably more realistic.
Right. So your study right now is planning to go on for how long, this work that you're doing to type mosquitoes in and around Missouri?
Basically for the rest of this summer. But there is, as part of the contract with the state, there is the option of extending it through multiple years. And I suspect that will depend a lot on what happens with Zika in the coming months. If Zika actually makes it into the mosquito population somewhere within the continental United States, then I suspect people will start having a lot more interest in these mosquitoes and what we can do to control them.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit more, because it seems like a perfect opportunity to discuss the intersection of a science-related field, and thus the name of the show, STEM Spots, with public policy. And so you talked a little bit about how you might be involved in some efforts at the state level to sort of think about plans in the future. So talk a little bit about that.
One of the things that has been kind of historical with things like disease vector control programs is that they were well funded early in the 20th century, and through the years, through our own success, wound up not being funded anymore. So some of the policies that are going to have to be addressed is, how much do we want to go back in and refund these programs and maintain them so that we at least have the capacity of responding quickly. In order to do that, we basically need a strategic plan that identifies the risk in the state of Missouri, identifies the assets that we have, and then comes up with a strategy for using those assets in the areas that have the greatest risk. And that's probably the first step that we want to go in.
I mean, one of the things that seems to me that's always a problem is the idea that people respond better to crisis most of the time post-crisis than they do on the front end. And so who would be doing the risk assessment part of this? You'd be bringing in some of the mosquito work and understanding the epidemiology and various kinds of things. But would you actually bring somebody into a team like that that would be able to formally do some amount of risk assessment to make people understand what the repercussions would be if you don't front end a program like this?
Well, there is the state health department, which does have a section on infectious diseases, and has a small section also actually on vector-borne diseases. And that's who we are collaborating with. And so that would be partly their role. However, it's important to note that they work directly with and in consultation with the CDC almost on a weekly basis. So a lot of this is locally driven by the state, but there is a collaboration with the CDC, and it brings in all of their substantial resources in virology and other aspects of disease control.
But would you agree that having some sort of, at least let's call it statewide plan at the minimum, is the right way to go in that, as you've already pointed out, there are a number of different ways you can address this problem, from standing water issues, from virology, from mosquito propagation. There's just a lot of things that can be considered. None of those could be considered completely at a local independent level, right? I mean, nothing would get done, really, it seems.
No, that's true, and that's kind of where the word public and public health comes from. There are certain things one can do on his own. There are others that have to be done by the community. And mosquito control is really one of those things. It has to be done at the community level.
I mean, does this also bring to mind this whole idea of vaccinations over the last, let's say, 15 years, when people don't remember what it's like when young children constantly got the measles, it becomes more difficult to make them aware of the risks associated with said scenario?
Yes, as I mentioned a little bit earlier, sometimes we're victims of our own success, and people forget just what pertussis was.
Right.
And they forget about certain diseases that used to scare people to death, polio, for instance. And we forget this, and we let those programs slide. And part of a good plan is to make sure, is to identify programs that need to be maintained even if they're not in the public eye and even if they're not currently having a large impact on the public health. In their absence, that public health impact grows.
Right. Well, David, I really appreciate you coming by and talking with us. And this is Dave Cornielsen talking with David Claiborne, who is the Interim Director of the Master's in Public Health in the College of Health and Human Services at Missouri State University. Thanks for stopping by, David.
It was my pleasure to be here. Thank you.
And once again, this is Dave Cornielsen signing off for STEM Spots.
STEM Spots is available online at ksmu.org.